Okay, good morning everyone. The topic that I'm going to talk about is some new advancements in genetics and how it interferes or helps halacha. Some of the issues are really developing as we are talking, so that maybe some of the information might be changing even within a week or two, certainly in the near future. But we are talking about what we know now. And that is why I put this slide to say that all the ethical halachic issues cannot be satisfactorily analyzed until they are understood, and they cannot be understood until the technologies are deployed in the real world. So whatever is still in the making, we can contemplate what the halachic outcome would be of such an invention or advancement. But as long as it's not really employed and working in the real world, it will probably be changing with time. So since we're talking about genetics, let me just give those who are not in the field a little brief understanding of what we know about genetics. In the ancient world, at least Aristotle and some others felt that the whole human being is encapsulated within the sperm, and what the woman does is she harbors the little human being in her womb who grows up until it comes out. So that the mother really doesn't contribute anything to the makeup of the child. That, surprisingly or not surprisingly, was understood differently by Chazal. And they already saw and said that both the father and the mother contribute equally to the development of the human being. So that there are three partners in the human being: the father, the mother, and the Kodesh Baruch Hu. Kodesh Baruch Hu gives the spiritual, metaphysic, thinking part of what we are. And the father and the mother each contribute certain parts of the body, which was a huge development in the understanding in the history of human being 2,000 years ago, when the world assumed that the mother has nothing to contribute except for carrying the pregnancy. And the reason basically was that the sperm was seen. So they knew that there is sperm that comes out of the male. But the egg, the female, other part of the creation of the human being, was never seen before the 17th century. So they didn't know what to expect of what the mother is contributing to the creation of the child. But once in the 17th century, with the microscope, people realized that there are eggs to the woman and sperm to the male, there was a huge dispute what is more important. And they still didn't understand that the combination is what creates the human being. And it took another 100 or so years before the understanding came that only the combination and the fertilization of the egg by the sperm is the beginning of the human being. You probably all know this development, Gregor Mendel, who was a priest who apparently was in a small place. He didn't do much of his time. He didn't know what to do with his time. So he made some experiments with peas, and he found out that there is some recessive development in it, so that the green and the yellow peas develop according to how they are bred together, and he developed the concept of the recessive and dominant genes without knowing the genes, but just speculating. He published it in 1865, but no one paid attention to it. What does a priest know about science? So he wrote an article and no one paid attention. Only 35 years later, a few young scientists who republished the same concept that Gregor Mendel has developed, and that caught, and from then on we know that there are recessive and dominant genes, and that is how certain traits and diseases are transmitted. 1953, Watson and Crick found out the makeup of the DNA, and then came genetic screening, genetic engineering, the Human Genome Project, and now we are at a stage where real advancements are being done in gene therapy. And that is what we will talk a little bit this morning. Now you all know that we are composed, if we are normal, of 46 chromosomes and an XY or XX germline cell, so that it's a male or a female, and there are about 3 billion codes of letters, and about 20,000 genes that were understood only when the Human Genome Project completed. Before that, we assumed that we have about 100,000 genes. How can we be with so few genes compared to the fly or the mosquito that have 15 or 12,000 genes? How far are we from the mosquito or the fly? We assume that it must be that we have many more, and yet that's all that we are different from the fly. And by now we know about 5,000 genetic syndromes that come from defective genes or whole chromosomes or missing parts of the genes or the chromosomes. And probably with time we'll discover more and more syndromes that by now they are not known to be genetically determined, but probably we'll find out that they are also some form of gene abnormality. So let's talk a little bit about what is called genetic engineering, which is a process of inserting new genetic information into existing cells in order to modify a specific organism for the purpose of changing its characteristics. So we have a gene, we want to make it different, to express a different type of modality, so we can make little changes in the genes in various ways. We can cut the gene, we can add to the gene, we can supplement the gene, we can add another gene that will work with this gene, we can play with the genomic material any way we want. So that includes transferring genes within and across species, not only within the same person, so that we can take a gene from a cow and put it into a monkey or vice versa in order to get certain things that we would like it to be. For instance, we know how the scale of the fish is produced by a certain gene. We can take a carp, and because the housewife doesn't want to clean the scales, although by now I think very few housewives do it, but I remember my mother working very hard to clean the carp, and by now you just take out this gene that creates the scale and you have a clean carp without any scales. What will be the ramifications from a halachic point of view? Would this be a kosher fish or not? You can take a gene from a lemon, insert it into an etrog, and give the etrog an appearance of etrog mehudar, which some do it in the regular way of breeding a lemon together with an etrog, which is called etrog murkav, which by most poskim is an etrog pasul. You can't use it because half of it is a lemon and not an etrog. But if you only insert the gene of the lemon into the etrog and you get the characteristics of an etrog that has lemon in it and it looks much nicer, it's more mehudar, would that change the state of the etrog from being an etrog kosher to an etrog murkav? These are all things that are being done almost in any aspect, and these will create probably difficult childless. You can take a gene that will make the pig ruminate, And since he already has this split hyphen, will he become a kosher animal? Because now he has the two signs of becoming a kosher animal. So these all are things that are feasible and probably can be done. Parah Adumah, hopefully soon Bet HaMikdash will be created. It used to be once in a lifetime that a cow would be totally red to be able to be used as a Parah Adumah. We know the gene that creates the color. Can we insert the gene in a regular Parah, make it a Parah Adumah, and then it won't be so expensive and it will be available? Will it be still a Parah Adumah? So these are things that we can do with some halachic implications. So that an organism that is generated through genetic engineering is considered to be genetically modified, and the resulting entity is a genetically modified organism. So this genetically modified organism can be a mouse, can be a human being, and can be crop, so that we can get better wheat and better other types of food and fruits that we are consuming. So as we know today already, and that works already, that can be done obviously in research, it's done already in agriculture, in industrial biotechnology, and it's now entering the field of medicine. And in medicine, we already know how to produce insulin and human growth hormone from animals, so that we can take the gene, the human gene that produces insulin, insert it in a certain animal, and the animal will produce human insulin that we can use. So that is already working, and we have it already working. So gene therapy is done by replacing defective gene with effective ones. So if I have a disease, let's say Tay-Sachs. Tay-Sachs is a terrible disease stemming from one gene that is abnormal. That's all. The whole genome, the whole 20,000 minus one genes are normal. There's only one gene that is abnormal, and this gene creates a terrible disease, creates Tay-Sachs. So we can just pull out the sick gene, implant from another one the healthy gene in this specific area, and there's no Tay-Sachs. So if we can do it in the embryo, then the child born will be free of the disease. So that is a form of therapy, much like giving antibiotics to kill a bacteria that causes pneumonia. It's actually the same process from a thinking point of view, just that we are playing with the genes. So we divide today the technology of genetic engineering to somatic gene therapy and germline gene therapy. Somatic gene therapy means that we take a somatic gene that creates a disease and we replace it or amend it or change it so that the disease will disappear. That affects only the individual who is sick. Whereas if we do the same in a germline cell, this will go on to further generations. So that if we make a mistake, and we'll talk about mistakes in a minute, in the somatic gene therapy, so we may lose an individual. But if we make a mistake in a germline gene, that will go on and on for many generations. So that is really a much more serious consideration. So today there is a term called genomic editing rather than genomic engineering. I'm not sure, I think the scientists themselves are not sure what the difference is between genetic engineering and genetic editing, by which the idea is that we are really either adding or subtracting or replacing or changing genes by ways that we are using certain enzymes that are called nucleases, and they serve as molecular scissors. So that, imagine that we have a strand, and in the middle there is a gene that we want to replace. We take a scissor, we cut the area that we are not happy with, and we take it out, and then there are enzymes that can put in this new place another gene that is either healthy or has other characteristics that we are interested in, and they fuse it, and that is what the other set of enzymes are doing. So that is what's called editing, so that we are really like editing a book. You write a book, you don't like a certain sentence, you cut it and you paste a different one, and you have the sentence that you like. So that is the idea of doing it with genes. Now, recently, a specific scissors have been discovered, which are called CRISPR-Cas9, which is the subtype of this CRISPR, which is a unique technology enabling medical researchers to edit or modify parts of genome by removing, editing, or altering sections of the DNA sequence. So in other words, the concept of genetic engineering or genetic editing is with us already at least 20 years. But recently, they found the appropriate scissors that are doing it in a very exact way. And actually, this has been discovered from bacteria. Bacteria have this inborn scissors in order to protect themselves from viruses. Viruses attack bacteria. The whole world is one is attacking a lower one. So the virus knows to attack bacteria. The bacteria are cutting the virus with those scissors so that they become ineffective in killing the bacteria. So it's in a way an immune system which is unique to the bacteria, as opposed to the immune system of the human being, which is composed on cells that recognize a foreign body and they attack it, the T cells that attack it. Here we are talking about a mechanism in the bacteria that cuts the DNA or the RNA of the virus so that the virus becomes ineffective in killing the bacteria. So researchers took the concept from the bacteria, applied it to genetic engineering or genetic editing by using this CRISPR-Cas9, which is a simple method that can be used to cut at will where we want to do it. Dr. Reifman mentioned last night as his first example of some of the newest advancements, the story of the FDA approving yesterday the autologous T cells that were modified in a way that they became like a weapon against cancerous cells. So that you take the T cells of the leukemic child who has no other options of treatment available, everything was done and failed, they take those T cells, they modify it in a way that the T cells recognize only cancerous cells, they inject it back to the child, and this attacks the leukemic cells, the cancerous cells, and kills it without affecting the normal cells. So that has been approved yesterday, as Dr. Reichman said. In Israel, we already did it in 17 cases before waiting for the FDA approval. The last one was published a week ago of a leukemic child who was already wheelchair bound, really going to die, had no hope, all the treatments were exhausted. They did this treatment to him, and within hours, the child got up and started rolling on a roller skate and riding a bicycle, and he's totally healthy. So that's really an amazing advancement that is already in effect. So as I said, the bacteria have this built-in system that is similar to the CRISPR-Cas9, and that has been adapted for human use in genetic editing that can be now done for various diseases. This also can be workable not only for human beings, it can be done for animals. You can do replacements of genes that will cause the cow to give more milk or to give a better type of milk. It can cause the ox to become more meaty so that when you get it, you get a better cut of meat. And you can do many, many other things of this kind. You can also modify the wheat and the fruits and get whatever you think is more beneficial to the consumption. There are, however, obviously, with every new and certainly such an advanced methodology, there are a whole host of ethical issues that people are starting to think about. So if we are talking about treatment, as we will see, certainly from a halachic point of view, there is no question that that should be permissible, provided it's safe, and we'll come to this in a minute. But that can be used also for enhancements, for modification and alterations of appearance, of adaptability, adaptability, intelligence, character, behavior, and so on. You can use it in order to make a child with blonde hair, if this is what you like better. You can do it for blue eyes, you can do it for height, you can do it for weight, you can do it for all kinds of things, because all are genetically determined. And once you identify the gene that causes this character, you can take the CRISPR, cut it out, put instead of it the gene that you want it to be, and get a child by design. And that obviously will create enormous problems distinguishing between treatment and enhancement, or whatever is called enhancement. It's not always enhancement, it's sometimes going back rather than forward, but people might think that this is what they want, and that will create certainly a problem. It can also create designer babies which are not always the best for the child because the parents want a certain appearance or character. One of the major questions are the safety. And the issue with the CRISPR is that sometimes it is working off target. So that if you want to cut a certain piece of the DNA, it may move a little, less than 0.1 millimeter to the right or to the left, and you'll cut the wrong part that you don't want to cut, and then a disaster will come. How can you do it in a safe way that what you want to take out, let's say you do it for a disease, you want to take out the gene for Tay-Sachs, but it didn't go off a little bit, and it took out the neighbor gene, so that the gene for Tay-Sachs is staying, and something good is taken out and replaced wrongly. So that is a major problem because you can imagine how narrow and small the DNA parts are, and you have to really know how to target it exactly, and that is now considered to be the major safety problem. There also are some changes which may indeed eliminate a harmful gene, but it may provoke other genes that were controlled by the harmful one. Now that it's not available, they will become the harmful one, and sometimes even more harmful than what we took out. Because as you know, there is a constant interaction between the genes. It's not that every gene works in its own island in its own environment and it works as it is. It has interactivities and interrelationship with other genes, and taking out one may provoke others, and we don't know what the results will be. Potentially, someone even can create weapon in this way for mass destruction, creating bacteria or viruses that will be harmful in an epidemiological way, and that is quite easily done by these technologies. Who can control North Korea or China or other places that will learn this mechanism, this methodology, which isn't difficult to do, and they will do things that will the world will regret. As far as genetically modified crops, they have to be safe, they sometimes cause harm to the environment, and there are several concerns on what to do with it. By the way, it's already in operation in certain places, and we still don't know if it's for the benefit or it will become detrimental. So now, how do we look at all these wonderful developments from a Jewish perspective? So let's start from the Hashkofa part. The belief is that we are determined by the genes. Whatever we do or don't do is because the genes tell us what to do. So if there is a determination, a predetermination, what is our free choice? What is our free will? How will we be rewarded for something good or punished for something bad if we will be able to prove that the fact that I stole or murdered was because of a gene that told me to do it and I couldn't control it? Or I gave a large sum of tzedakah, who says I did it because I wanted to do it? Maybe I have a gene that tells me this is what you have to do, it's not my choice anyway. So how is sahar ve'onesh, punishment and reward, go along with such a situation? So there are already in the Talmud and in the Midrashim some hints that such things can be an issue. For instance, the Gemara says he was born under mazal of Ma'adim, of Mars, which is red, will shed blood. Because he was born under this genetic makeup, he was born at a time where Mars was controlling the world, he automatically will become a person who sheds blood. But within this tendency, he can modify it at will, because he can be either a surgeon who sheds blood, right? All surgeons do it all the time, or a murderer. It's not to compare, but the end result is very similar, or a butcher, or a moyer. So I have the tendency to shed blood, but I can control myself and use it either for the good or for the bad. And that is exactly what free will is. So we are not totally free. Obviously, there are tendencies in everyone, one way or the other, either for the better or for the worse, but we have the power to control. So already Chazal, if you take away the mazal ma'adim and you place instead of it a gene that causes a tendency to shed blood, you still have the free will to finish it. Okay. So I'll skip the story about Moshe Rabbeinu. It's a very nice story. You want to hear it?
Yes.
So you have to give me more time. There's a trade-in. There is a medrash that no one found ever, which is quoted by the Tiferet Israel in the early editions, and subsequently in the later editions, it was taken out. But he quotes a medrash saying that the king of Arab heard about Moshe Rabbeinu, what a great person he was. So he sent his expert in drawing to draw. He couldn't send a person with an iPhone, obviously. In those days, they didn't have to take a photo. So there was someone who painted Moshe Rabbeinu. In his court, he had an expert in physiology who could assess the character of a person through the makeup of the face. So this one drew the face of Moshe Rabbeinu, comes back to the king of Arab, he shows it to his expert, and he says, this is a very evil man. So he said, either the drawing of Moshe Rabbeinu was wrong, all your expertise in assessing according to the faith is wrong because we hear about him such wonderful things. So one of you has to be executed because you didn't do your job. But before doing it, let me send someone to Moshe Rabbeinu and ask him who is right and who is wrong. So comes this person with a drawing, and Moshe Rabbeinu says, perfect drawing, that's exactly me. So he said, but this person who is an expert in faces said you're an evil man. He said, he's right. I was born as an evil man, but I worked upon myself and I became Moshe Rabbeinu. So that is to show, supposedly, that even from the worst, you can become the best. No one ever reached the Madrega of Moshe Rabbeinu, and he started as an evil man. The reason it was taken out was that it's hard to believe that Moshe Rabbeinu was created as an evil man, and even if the moral of it is a good one, the example used is bad, and there was no such medrash ever found. So let me go a little quicker about what we are doing with this information. So is it an interference in nature? That is really the question. Here is someone born with Tay Sachs, I take scissors, I take out the gene of Tay Sachs, I replace it with another gene, and he's a healthy person. Did I interfere in nature? And already Dr. Reitman alluded to it earlier, and I think we discussed it in previous conferences. Our job as physicians, was a questionable profession from a moral point of view, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants someone to be sick or to be disabled or to be wounded. Who are we as human beings who go against HaKadosh Baruch Hu? And we give him antibiotics, or we suture him, or we replace his heart by a transplant, or he is infertile and we are doing fertility technology and it becomes better. So Verapo Yerapeh Mikan Shenitna Reshut LaRofe Lerapeh, and we don't say God smites and man heals. And the reason for it, and there are many such examples which for time limit I won't go over it, but you can see it in the book of references and you can look it up. All these point to the fact that indeed, HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the world in a certain way, but he didn't finish the creation. We say, every soon we'll say it this evening, and we finish it, Asher bara Elokim la'asot. God created the world to be done. God didn't create the world and it was done with. God created it with a potential to continue to be developed. And that is our task as human beings, to continue to develop the world as messengers of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So the difference between a secular feeling that we are smart, we know, we are changing the world because we know how to do it, that is only partially correct. Yes, we know how to do it, but we have to understand that we are just messengers to do the world better, and that is our obligation to do it. V'chibshua, we should conquer the world. We should do it. But we should always remember that we are doing it as messengers and not because we think that we are smart and therefore we can do it. The outcome of such an approach is that we should do it only for the benefit of human beings and not to do it for detrimental outcomes. And therefore, I don't see any difference between genetic engineering, genetic editing, using CRISPR or some other enzymes that will probably be invented in the near future, compared to using antibiotics, organ transplants, fertility technology. They are all interventions in nature in a way that no one ever believed or even thought that it could be this way, and yet it is happening, and that is not different only because it's new than any other of our endeavors. Thank you very much.